Hi, this is Paul. A little bit earlier, was it last week or this week? What day did I put out that video about Cosmic Skeptic? Anyway, a bunch of you said, "Oh, you should talk about the Cosmic Skeptic video," basically you should watch it. And I'd seen a little bit of it, and it annoyed me, and so I sort of put it away. And then a bunch of people said, no, you should watch it. You should say something about it. And so I watched and it really annoyed me and I made a video right away. And so that's drummed up a little drama. And that's a little bit of drama is not such a bad thing. If you have absolutely no drama, you're probably not alive. But for me, it raises and it connects to a huge conversation going on in the evangelical world between sort of the Tim Keller winsome approach David French is often mentioned in that conversation as well, and those who want to take a harder line. On a very small channel from a church, Westminster Presbyterian Church in Battleground, that's the name of the town, in Battleground, Washington, held a conference on the Negative World Conference. And they had Aaron Wren and James Wood. I should probably have both Aaron and James on. I met Aaron at the Chicago Estuary event, and I've really appreciated Aaron's work for quite a long time. I think Aaron spends more time paying attention to what I think is the really big story in the Christian nationalist conversation than a bunch of people who write about it and are waving the flag of Christian national, dread Christian nationalism all over the place. Aaron Wren actually thinks about and talks about the mainline movement, which is a huge piece of that conversation, which is almost always ignored because the mainline movement basically went, basically covered its Christianity, much of it covered its Christianity, left the church, and became sort of nakedly political. And so Aaron Wren is a voice. He's the one that came up with sort of the three worlds of evangelicalism, that motif. And he did that a number of years ago, and it's been gaining steam because I think he's right about a lot of it. And at this conference that happened on September 9, 2022, he walked through the three worlds, and in the best possible world, I would do a commentary on that entire talk and the next talk, which was absolutely outstanding. I found the second talk he gave brimming with fresh insights, stuff to think about, hard things to chew on, just a tremendous piece of work by Aaron Wren. Deeply, deeply appreciate it. It doesn't mean I agree with everything he's saying, but I think he, more than just about anybody else around, is really wrestling with a lot of these issues. Now, of course, he's doing it from his own perspective, but we all do stuff from our own perspectives. So there's that. But even in this little corner, I very much am, in some ways, Team Winsome. Tim Keller was a big influence on me in the aughts. By about 2006, for a whole number of reasons that I'm not going to go into right here, I was really burned out. I was sort of at the end of a whole bunch of different ropes in my ministry in a whole bunch of different ways, and I found Tim Keller, and I listened to 2, 3, 4 Tim Keller talks a day. I did a deep dive into Tim Keller the way... about 10 years later, I did a deep dive into Jordan Peterson. And those of you who know me, I'm sort of like Chad the alcoholic. I'm kind of an all or nothing guy. When I latch onto something, I really do latch onto it. And I get a little obsessive. And so I did that with Keller. And Keller deeply impacted me. There are real important historical connections between my story and Keller's story. Keller is about 12 years older than I am, but he very much grew out of the urban ministry movement in the 1970s, that Roger Greenway, Harvey Kahn, a whole bunch of people in Westminster, Seminary East were involved with. And my father's church was involved in that stuff. I remember one summer, my father was a speaker at a camp and I was a kid. So those in many ways are my people, along with the CRC and along with the Patterson folks. I mean, I have lots of people in my crazy diverse story. So even while I deeply appreciate Aaron Wren, I still continue to deeply appreciate Tim Keller. Now, I get regular chidings from my friend Bethel, who says, well, you haven't followed Keller carefully enough for the last 10 years. You don't know all the things he said on Twitter. You don't know how he's been soft on this and that and this and that. And then if I mention David French, who, quite frankly, many of the things I read about him I appreciate, whoa, I'm going to get a lot of blowback from my friends Bethel and many more that will come my way. I'm thinking of you, Hank. And so, but I like a good scrap. I like a little controversy. I like a little picante in my salsa. And so, yeah, let's have this talk. Let's do this thing. I think this is one of the most important things going on right now, because what we're really working through together are these questions about Jesus. Because Jesus, on one hand, clearly launches, let's say, the nonviolent Anabaptist tradition of the church, where Jesus dies at the hands of his enemies for those who were still yet sinners. But Jesus also could turn over the money changers and say woe to you and wield phrases like whitewashed tombs. Jesus could do both things. And the questions for us are, how do we operate in this culture war now? I've said many times on my channel, Jesus is our guide to living through a culture war. Jesus is our master. He's our guide. He's our teacher. If we want to know how to do it right, we should look at Jesus. We should study Jesus carefully. Now, this, of course, leads to a big difference between myself and Jacob, let's say. So in this little corner, we have our own little winsome or non-winsome debate between me and Jacob, because Jacob, of course, I'm too easy. Mark's sort of on the non-winsome team too, and there's a bunch of others. When I feel bad and sort of apologize for going off on Cosmic Skeptic or Sam Harris, you know, Mark and Jacob, like, don't apologize, go in more. And others of you are like, no, this isn't what your brand is about. You're Team Winsome. And, well, I'm not quite as consistently winsome as some of you would like me to be. And I'm certainly not quite as picante as others of you would like to be. And so this is a huge issue, I think. And it's something we have to talk about and work through. And fortunately, in the evangelical world, there are a lot of good people working on this. And in fact, Keller recently wrote a really good piece, I thought. Bethel sent it to me. Mere Orthodoxy, for those of you who, now I know, given my audience, some of you are going to read that and say, oh, an Orthodoxy blog. Not really that Orthodoxy. Mere small, low Orthodoxy. There's sort of a, I'd say in some ways, if the intellectual dark web was really mostly made up of disaffected, but increasingly sort of neo. So in some ways, Mere Orthodoxy is kind of intellectual dark web-ish for evangelicals. They're not. So, you know, of course, the emergent, you have the seeker movement, which really gets rolling in the 80s and 90s, Tim Keller, Rick Warren, then followed by the emergent movement, where you have Rob Bell, Mark Driscoll, Nadia Boltz-Weber. And so the emergent movement just fractures. After the emergent movement, these guys are post-emergent, and they're very much, let's say, Orthodox adjacent, in that, generally speaking, this cadre of, in my own denomination, I often call them the Reformed Catholics, they're what church planters, they were the next generation after the Seeker church planters. Some CRC church planters tried the emergent movement, but it really didn't work for them when they said, no, we're just going to do community development. We're not actually going to do evangelism and discipleship. Most of them wound up without a church at all. So these people, mere orthodoxy, are very much into liturgy, Book of Common Prayer, weekly communion, you know, stuff that many people in this neo-sacramentalism, as I call it, many people in this little corner would feel comfortable with. Now, apparently there was an incident in Australia where, well, I'll just read a little bit of this article because Tim Keller sets it up. Watching David Koch skewer evangelical pastor Guy Mason on Australia's morning show Sunrise was an excruciating experience. Andrew Thornburg had been dismissed for his association with a City on a Hill church just a couple of days after being appointed chief executive of a professional Australian football club. The reason given was that the church held to traditional Christian positions on abortion and homosexuality. These beliefs were now declared as beyond the pale for someone prominent in Australian public life. Thornburn would not dismiss his beliefs with the media, so Sunrise invited the pastor of Thornburn's church, Guy Mason, to be interviewed instead. Now, I'm not going to show the video here because I fear the YouTube will, you know, pull it down. And then, you know, then I have to re-edit the video or something like that. And I don't really want to. So I'm basically going to play a little bit of the audio of it. If you think about Jordan Peterson and Kathy Newman, this is the opposite. I think I'll pause the video here so I can do the editing easily if, in fact, YouTube doesn't like what I'm doing now.
Good to see you, David.
You know Andrew Thorburn personally, he's the chair of your board. Do his personal views align with your hardline views of the church on...
Now notice, like, Kathy Newman, I mean, the interviewer here, I'll just... The interviewer here, there's his picture, the guy on the left here, he sort of sets it up. And the poor pastor doesn't do as well as Jordan Peterson in this at all, as you're about to hear.
Abortion and homosexuality.
I know Andrew to be a great man. He's a man of integrity, generosity, warmth, and he's a man of faith. And I admire that in him. It shapes who he is. He loves his faith. He loves his footy. And I hope we could live in a world where we can express our faith and we can do that and celebrate that.
But do his views align with the church's on abortion and homosexuality?
Well, the Christian view is one of life, and it's one of love.
Now, first of all, he should have just said, yes, he does. These are our views. This is what we believe. But instead of sort of making that stance, he nuances. And that's a tactical decision, fair enough, but... that's what he does.
And that's what we stand for. That's what we want to proclaim, that Jesus is all about life and he's all about love. And I'm sure that Andrew would agree with that. You'd need to ask him his views, but...
No. He hasn't given his views. You know him well. He wouldn't be chairman of your board unless he shared exactly the same views that the church does.
Well, what's at the heart of our church is a passion to know Jesus and make Jesus known. We seek to shine that light, love people, serve people, build communities, plant...
But comparing abortion to the Holocaust and homosexuality as sin is not love, it's not inclusion. Mm. There are so many other churches that are tolerant, are inclusive. Mm. You all read the same book.
Yeah.
Why do you have this hard line... Mm. and not so loving view?
Mm. Well, we're talking about a quote was from probably 10 years ago, and the intention was not to be inflammatory. The words were wrong. I'd use different words today. The essence of the message, though, was that Jesus is all about life. We're inclusive. We're not homophobic. We're for life and we're for love.
You're not homophobic.
No.
You say homosexuality is a sin.
Well, the Bible holds up marriage as a gift from God for one man, one woman. Yes, that's a mainstream Christian view. I'm an Anglican.
But it wasn't even discussing homosexuality. It's a 2,000-year-old document. Come on, it was a different time. It was a different era.
So the news guy basically just new atheists, the pastor, and the pastor's got nothing. And again, you know, this is not Jordan Peterson and Kathy Newman. So, and I feel for the guy. And so Keller picks up from there. Oh, I should redo this. Keller writes, "I could not be more sympathetic to Mason, because I have been through many media interviews, and you always, always come home thinking of things you should have said." And that's absolutely right. And my point here is not to, you know, if Mason would even watch this thing, which I doubt, because we are a very small channel, and that's kind of how I like it. If Mason would watch this thing, I certainly wouldn't want to. Would I do better? I have no idea. Probably not. But yeah. Keller has been on the big stage a lot. "It's easy for us to the rest of us to watch the recording and imagine from the tranquility of our easy chairs better responses to the interviewer. I am more interested in the lessons being drawn from the incident by writers such as Simon Kennedy, David Uhl, and others who have been following the lead of James R. Wood." Okay, and James Wood is someone, again, that he had... Oh, okay, here's the... James, I think I don't know if I talked about this. James Wood had a piece, how I evolved on Tim Keller, and he brings in, I'll put the links below. He of course mentions Aaron Wren's account, Aaron Wren. You know, for those of you who know anything about the Christian blogosphere, I mean, First Things has been evolving over the years too. There's a lot of evolution on all sorts of fronts because the context continues to change. "They all, in one form or another, assume the Leslie Newbegin theme that the church must change as Christendom wanes in Western societies. The goodwill, deference, and respect that the broader culture once had for church has vanished, and in its place is increasingly hostile. This also happens in stages. 10 years ago, Stefan Pass began writing of a different level of secularity, antipathy to Christianity. Post-Christendom, post-modernity, post-Christianity recognizes that some places in Europe are more secular and hostile to Christian faith than others. More recently, Aaron Wren similarly argued that U.S. culture moved from a positive view of Christianity to a negative view, and now a neutral view, and now a negative view. Newbegin stressed the churches were declining because they continued to speak and minister as if it was Christendom culture, and it is not. He was certainly right that the church is still not adapted to a deepening post-Christendom. Kennedy, Uhl, and Wood are likewise warning that use of public discourse appropriate to Christendom or even neutral worlds is a mistake, that we are in a negative world. All three writers say that the conciliar, nice, relevant, winsome, and compassionate tone and stance no longer works. Now, a big question is going to be, what do we mean by works? You know, obviously, with my little discussion with Jacob, getting nailed to a cross by the Romans, Jacob would argue, doesn't mean works. And this is part of the reason that if you don't believe in the part of the story of the resurrection of Jesus and his ascension, which are key parts of it, the story is very different. The story would be another, the Romans killed another Jew. That's all the story would be, because the Romans were good at killing Jews along with all the other enemies that they had in the empire. The Romans were very good at it. But of course, if Jesus rose from the dead and ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of God the Father, well, it's a different story. Kennedy calls this the seeker-sensitive approach. It is one that agrees with opposite views where possible, that avoids confrontation, that keeps non-abrasive tone, and keeps to remain credible and attractive to secular people. Now, seeker-sensitive is an interesting word, is an interesting way to phrase it there. Still really haven't figured out where all I want the camera. Seeker-sensitive is an interesting way to phrase it, because I said before, you had the seeker-sensitive movement in the 80s and 90s, and then in the aughts, you much more had sort of a neutral phase, and then, you know, if we go through Wren's lecture, which I highly recommend, both of Wren's lectures there were good. I thought Woods was good too. I'd like to deal with some of that. I want to have, James Wood is now teaching at Redeemer University, which was founded by Christian Reformed people in Ontario, Canada. So he's someone that I think would probably come on my channel. Maybe I can have him and Wren on at the same time. I'd love to have, I don't know if I could uphold Team Winsome by myself. I've never reached out to Tim Keller. He's been doing some interviews. I caught some really good podcasts that he was on. I don't like sort of just chasing down people all the time in the channel, but I definitely would talk to Tim Keller because I'm a big fan. And Tim Keller, via the internet, I did meet him. One of my colleagues had an in for like a covert pastor conference that he used to kind of do on the QT. And so I did go to New York and I did participate in that. And so I did get a chance to meet him and go to his apartment and have dinner and meet his wife and do all those things. And so, again, I'm a huge fan of Keller, have been for a long time. And I just set Bethel's teeth on edge. And you too, Hank, I know, but I love you all still. Kennedy argues that the world has shifted, and therefore the age of conciliar cultural engagement is over. No longer will being nice and relevant cut it. But again, cut it in terms of what? And that's really what you have to ask yourself, is different speech and different postures and different relationships and different contexts are going to pursue different ends. So then Keller says, a theology of public engagement. Here's a proposal for a way of doing public engagement now, which differs not only from the seeker-sensitive approach, but also the new and admittedly underdeveloped just tell the truth approach. And that's part of it. We don't really have a new, I don't think seeker-sensitive, but I think winsome is better. We don't really have a new term for the other side. And so what Keller does in this article actually is sort of work things out. He references 1 Corinthians 2. I wasn't real enamored by actually his use of that text in this way, but I really liked sort of the three approaches. Affection. Despite it all, Pastor Mason remains kind, unruffled, calm, courteous, and respectful during the entire interview. Plus, that's a good thing for the most part. Because in my view, I should mention that one of the conversations that I started, there's so much good content right now I want to listen to. Marcus is doing an amazing job. The smaller randos channels like Grimm and Jacob and sort of the new evolution of more open chatting on the internet, there's so much going on right now. I've got my own estuary going. There's so much good stuff going on, but this conversation with Robert Wright and Brett Weinstein, it's so much fun. And this is part of, not only do we have to deal with, say, context, different in context, we have to deal with different media. Because, so of course, here's a fun story. I was talking to my sister on our weekly Zoom talk, and she mentioned she was going to sleep, and I gotta find that video now too. And apparently my sister and I have some disagreements about a number of things. One of the podcasts my sister listens to is the Myth Vision podcast, and my sister was going to sleep and the podcast was on, and you know, she didn't have a sleep timer turning it off, and it was just going on, and she was kind of drowsy, in sleep and out of sleep and in sleep and out of sleep, and what comes up but, oh shoot, where is it? I gotta find it. What comes up is Jordan Peterson being purposely deceptive when it comes to God and the Bible? And who's on this podcast but our own Nathan? So my sister is just listening to, and then she's just kind of in and out of sleep, and then she hears Paul Vanderclay, and she's like, what? Paul Vanderclay? And then she wakes up, and she's like, someone's attacking my brother. And of course, she's my big sister, so wherever she stands on any of this, it's like, who's attacking my brother? This is my brother. Don't attack my little brother. So,
faculty again, Hanny. Jordan Peterson appeals to irreligious people who are not ready or not yet ready to abandon God. It seems that there is a...
I'm not sure about his definition of irreligious, if he's really holding to the secular new atheist definition of religious or irreligious.
Niche of growing population within this stage.
I think that's right. And I think that a lot of those people who lean more religiously get filtered into like people like Jonathan Peugeot or Paul Vanderclay, who are like these Jordan Peterson adjacent, like, religious Christian types. And then, but they're very, you know, if you talk to any of the people that you might have known as a Christian, or if you look at the apologists like Braxton Hunter or Cameron Bertuzzi or whatever, they would be like, what the hell, like, these people, what the hell do they believe? Like,
yeah, this is that's how I felt about him. And then here's another one. This is in the same vein, made by Jim Bob. Thank you. Jordan Peterson's task is to reformat, or I'll use the term redefine, this theism as a
So that was very fair and very nice. So, but my sister just like, someone talking about my brother? Well, this conversation here, which I really want to go through and listen more to.
Explanation. It means that it is a proposal for something that might explain a pattern, something that makes predictions, and that it deserves to be on the table of potential explanations. Okay. Now, it happens that I do think that this one is plausible, but you do not have, logically speaking, you don't have the right to try to get me to fill out the picture of how this corruption might work.
You don't have to state what your hypothesis is. I took it to be that there's somebody in the executive branch corrupting our policy intentionally. You're saying, no, I didn't mean that. Well, then what did you mean? What is your hypothesis?
Let me then look, we are going to get to the.
So basically, after 2 hours, these two didn't make much progress.
Where I lost it, but hey, let's talk because we've got other topics. It doesn't really work like that. So.
Okay. Will you at least consult with Heather? Because she got my tweet right. She interpreted my tweet correctly.
Well,
maybe she'll watch this and find me charming. You never know.
Perhaps. In any case, Robert, I'm going to recommend that people check out your book, Non-Zero. I still think it's a great book.
I appreciate that.
Well worth the read. I wish I could say it had been a pleasure talking, but I think it is potentially been.
Well, I've enjoyed it. All right. Well, sorry.
All right.
See ya.
Talk to you later.
Affection. Not a lot of affection there. Despite it all, Pastor Mason remains kind, unruffled, calm, courteous, and respectful during the entire interview because, in my view, he was less persuasive and resolute. He was less persuasive and resolute than he could have been. See below. I grant that his demeanor seemed to be just niceness, but I think we should give him credit here. His interviewer used many of the rhetorical devices that Paul forbids in 1 Corinthians 2, mocking, belittling language, demagoguery rather than real argument. Guy Mason did not respond in kind. When reviled, he did not revile in return, 1 Peter 2:23. I believe the pastor showed some of the fruit of the Spirit. I'd agree with that. And that's affection has a tremendous power. It really does. Resolution, however. The interviewer immediately and repeatedly asked about the church's views on abortion and homosexuality. Instead of articulating them unapologetically, Pastor Mason seemed to avoid them. I don't know how much of this was driven by the seeker-sensitive approach and how much of it was just the influence of contemporary media training. Pick up any book on media training for politicians and business leaders, and it will tell you to choose your positive talking points ahead of time and then stay on message. I've seen politicians especially ignore this ignore unpleasant questions and just repeat the talking points. Happens all the time, and maybe that's in fact what the pastor is doing. Whether or not this is a fair analysis in this case, Pastor Mason did not appear to be calmly confident in the historic teaching of the Bible. Now these on these now controversial issues. Persuasive. Under the heading, much more could have been done in the interview. Pastor Mason tacitly accepted the argument that the church must be accepting and inclusive of everybody, and in effect, he kept saying, we are. And this is something that you can see, I mean, this is something, if you listen to Keller, even in the aughts, he had a lot of these down lines down really well, and they obviously were effective because he was able to gather into himself a lot of different people. Now, part of what developed on Twitter was a question about, what's her name, Kirsten Powers? So she started going to Redeemer, and she was a nationally known journalist who was affirming of LGBTQ. Eventually, apparently, and I might get this wrong, correct me in the comment section if I do, she left Redeemer because they were not affirming or sufficiently affirming or empowering to the use of women's gifts in ministry, and so she went to a mainline. Nope, she didn't go to a mainline. She went to the Catholics. And that should tell you something. That's got to tell you something about the current atmosphere. Now, I know I pulled Cale Zeldin into that, which, of course, to make him blush, but this has to do with Protestantism and the way that Catholicism ironically gets a pass on many of these issues, even when in terms of applying aspects of, let's say, the positive, neutral, and negative world conflict lists, Catholics get a pass, which is amazing, which of course drives some Catholics absolutely nuts. So Pastor Mason could have taken a much more Protestant confessional turn than this, because actually confessionalism is intended to deal with these types of questions. Koch's main strategy in the interview was to paint the traditional Christian position as extreme and therefore non-inclusive. So when Koch asked the first question about the hardline views of the church on abortion and homosexuality, it would have been appropriate for Mason to ask a counter question, which, if you go and listen to Kathy Newman and that interview, that's exactly what Jordan Peterson does again and again and again. And I think Jordan Peterson's performance in that interview is just sort of the standard. I haven't seen anyone do it better. In fact, you know, Jordan himself, and this is nothing against Jordan, because I'll tell you, every Sunday I preach a sermon, there are some Sundays that are better than others, and after I'm dead and gone and no longer writing sermons, people will be able to find perhaps a sermon and say, Paul Vanderclay never preached a better sermon than this. I don't know if Jordan Peterson will ever give a better interview than what he did with Kathy Newman. It was a masterpiece in dealing with this, and for that reason, it's so utterly famous, and people use it on this point all the time. But this is part of what Keller has always done with these kinds of things. So, with all due respect, David, your term hard line sounds like you are calling our views extreme. But just under 2 billion people, a quarter of the world's population, is Muslim, and they hold the same views. Are you saying no Muslim could ever be the CEO of a public football club? And again, Keller also knows his context. So, that would really go in England, let's say, where there's a significant Islamic population. I don't know the size of the Islamic population in Australia, but that's Keller's got those tools, and you can find Keller using them. He just does it with such affection and winsomeness that it really goes well. Such a question uses secular person's own cultural narrative, that of diversity and the value of racial minorities, against them. If Koch had responded by, yes, I don't think Muslims should be club CEO, Mason would have responded by that now Koch was being non-inclusive. And if more than 3/4 of the world's population that doesn't hold the secular view of sexuality are excluded, now who is being extreme? And if you say, well, those people haven't been enlightened yet, how is that just not another example of Western superiority and imperialism? Aren't you doing the very marginal marginalization and exclusion you're complaining about? So Keller basically has these three poles, which I think are really helpful: affection, resolution, and persuasion. So the summary, let's oversimplify a bit for the sake of clarity. The seeker-sensitive approach stresses affection over resolution. The just tell the truth approach stresses resolution over affection. But neither approach does much in or holds much hope for persuasion. And this, of course, is what you want to do. You want to be persuasive. I think Keller's points hold true far more broadly than just evangelicalism, because in many ways, most conflicts within evangelicalism are sort of proxy fights of many conflicts within the broader American culture. Evangelicalism is so American and so pervasive and so widespread that if we can learn from these debates, I think we can, in fact, have practices beyond them. So maybe I'll stop this video here and dig into this in another video.